Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Well, the Old Town Jazz Festival is this weekend, and what you're hearing is our contribution to it. Heartland Klezmorim, the Lansing Basque band, they will be playing at the Great Lakes Folk Festival next weekend. And there are live music contributors here on Live Music Friday on Current State. We'll be chatting up the members of the band later on this hour. I see in the news here today that the Lansing School District, Kathleen Levy reports in today's Lansing State Journal, that the Lansing School District is going to be hiring a firm to analyze structural issues and to project the cost of renovating Eastern and Sexton High Schools, as well as the closed Otto Middle School. We will point out that on Monday, here on this program, we'll have on Lansing President of the Lansing School Board, Peter Spadafore, along with District Superintendent Yvonne Kamal Kanul, to talk about this and about the Lansing School District's new strategic plan and how this fits into that. The ongoing discussion in Lansing, of course, for a long time, or the topic that's popped up most frequently, is whether or not the district should close a high school. This would suggest maybe they're moving in another direction. They'll be keeping all those buildings open. We'll learn more on Monday from Ms. Kanul and Mr. Spadafore here on Current State. Speaking of education, Michigan education stakeholders met with state officials this week. Those meetings included State School Superintendent Michael Flanagan. Discussions included toughening the oversight of the state's charter schools. On Monday, Flanagan met with charter school authorizers. He explained his previous warning to stop authorizations by bodies that demonstrate poor oversight. On Wednesday, Flanagan continued discussions with a diverse group of education stakeholders. To learn more about what happened at that Wednesday meeting, we welcome an attendee. Dan Quisenberry is president of the Michigan Association of Public School Academies. Welcome to Current State, Dan.
It's great to be here, Mark, and thanks for the music.
Certainly.
Great.
That was all for you.
Thank you, sir.
We didn't tell you that, but that was all for you. This is interesting. Monday's meeting with Superintendent Flanagan was with authorizers of charter schools.
Yes.
These are bodies at Michigan universities and intermediate school districts with particular responsibilities in the charter school world. Let's focus on Wednesday's meeting, though. Besides yourself, who exactly attended Wednesday's meeting?
There was approximately 50 different individuals, mostly executives or representatives from the state's varying associations or the sectors of the education community. So the unions, the school administrators, school boards association, some researchers, and different groups that speak on behalf of education policy.
I wanted to clarify that because I thought I had read reports that it would be with charter school supporters, which you clearly are, but I bring this up because of that report. I'm learning it was really a much more diverse group, not all of whom would necessarily be considered charter school supporters.
Correct.
Out of the
50, I was in the small minority.
Okay. Small minority.
Yes.
What was Superintendent Flanagan's main message at your meeting?
Well, I think it's the same meeting that was held on Monday, which is he knows he has authority. He's had conversations about this. His job is to keep all of our public schools focused on student performance, make sure their business practices are sound and driven towards academic performance. And this is a particular focus on his authority over authorizers and how would he go about evaluating a circumstance when he needs to exercise that if an authorizer is perceived to be not doing their job. So should he look at academics? Should he look at their contracts, at their portfolio? He's getting input for that decision or that kind of decision.
Okay, very interesting. And you broke into small groups, I'm told. What was that about?
A good way to get input for the department staff and for the superintendent. So topics were thrown out. How would we go about looking at academics? How would we go about looking at the contracts? How might we go about looking at a process they've constructed on assurance and verification? Just allow the 50 different people to have some individual voice. So there are about 5 different groups. There's moments of dialogue and discussion. Then we'd report out to each other. It was a good facilitated process to get input for the department.
On Tuesday, we had on this program Brad Weaver, who's with the Engler Center for Charter Schools at Central Michigan University, one of the state's biggest authorizers of charter schools. And we spent some time talking about the contracts that are written between the management companies of charter schools and the boards that are charged with overseeing them. Did contracts come up at your meeting or not?
The focus here was largely on the superintendent's role, and his role is specifically between the department and authorizers. A charter is a contract, so there's confusion. Sometimes in the meeting on Wednesday, there was as much informative discussion as there was feedback, meaning legitimately people were asking questions. Okay, mm-hmm. Tell me about this contract and the checklist that the department goes through. Let's understand it before we start to provide feedback. So it was a focus on the charter itself as opposed to underlying contracts.
Did you and the other charter supporters at Wednesday's meeting, did you raise any particular points?
There was two kind of things generally. One, it was gratifying in a way that there was people left the meeting, I think, more enlightened about the kinds of and the sophistication level of oversight and details that are reviewed on a regular basis. That was kind of pleasing in a way. The other is just the challenge of digging into this, meaning what part of the subjective things that go on an authorizer's capacity. When is it enough? When is it good? When is it bad? How do you make those decisions? Those kinds of conversations were there. So good conversation.
Dan Quisenberry is our guest on Current State. Dan heads the Michigan Association of Public School Academies. What do you make of Superintendent Flanagan's willingness to stop additional authorizations of those bodies with poor oversight? He's made it clear he wants to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had the pleasure of working with Superintendent Flanagan throughout his tenure, and he's always made it clear, always. If this school of any school wasn't good enough for his grandkid to attend, wasn't good enough for his daughter to teach at, then nobody should be going to it. So he's looking here, and certainly he's serious about that. But it's also a preliminary thing. You know, there's a lot of discussion about it, so he's preparing. Should a circumstance arise, I don't think he has one that's pending necessarily, how will he make that decision? And he wants input from people before he would have to make that kind of decision so that, frankly, we could be very supportive because there's a willingness in the charter sector particularly of saying he should exercise that authority if under some particular circumstance an authorizer was not doing their job. We would want him to act.
You're a guy who's in a position to know, and I've got to ask you, how big an issue is poor oversight by authorizers of Michigan's charter schools?
It's both a very important discussion, but in terms of, Dan, do you think there's problems there? Michigan's held up around the country is really an example of how to go about good authorizing. So again, we don't think there's a pending problem looming. He may find something in this process of discovering how he would evaluate that, but we've got a number of authorizers. You mentioned the universities, but intermediate school districts, community colleges, the fastest growing part of that are actually local school districts. And it may be more of a situation of a local school district not knowing what they're doing, and he may need to step in and say, hey, you know what? You've been making some mistakes. This isn't good for education. I'm going to correct it. That wouldn't surprise me if it happened.
The Detroit Free Press series on charters back in June reported a series of pretty serious problems involving some Michigan charter schools. I'd like to ask you about several of the points that they raised, and you have responded publicly already, but I feel like we need to revisit this. One of the biggest points they made was that $1 billion in Michigan taxpayer money goes to charters, and much of it, they reported, is not accounted for. How much oversight, how big a problem is that?
Well, that was an extreme exaggeration. $1 billion is the approximate amount of money. Every dollar that goes to a charter public school in the state of Michigan, there is no way, Mark, that every single dollar is being misspent or isn't being monitored in some way. In fact, it's probably more closely monitored than other dollars that are spent in public education.
Where did they get that figure, though?
You need to ask. Well, again, it's 130,000 students times the approximate $7,000, and they're coming up with.
You don't quarrel with the fact that $1 billion.
It's $1 billion. Okay, but it's basically saying every penny that goes to every charter school in the state is being mismanaged and not overseen. That's not correct.
It, it, I mean, Would you hazard a guess as to what percentage of that $1 billion is questionably overseen?
All of it's overseen. If it's a question of something that's misspent, it's going to be a very small percentage of it. And the examples they actually cited in the series, 42 articles over 8 days, after 20 months of investigation, they found about a handful of examples, all of which actually showed that the checks and balances in the system worked, because in every single one of those cases, an authorizer had discovered it, intervened, and if necessary, convicted bad actors.
Another assertion by the Free Press series, a number of chronically low-performing charter schools stay in business for years, and it just perpetuates.
Another myth. If you pull up the performance measures by their own standards, there's 20 schools on that list. 19 are traditional public schools. One was a charter public school, and the authorizer in that case, Detroit Public Schools, was all over them, monitoring what they were doing and taking action. So we don't know where they came up with that conclusion.
Do you concede anything? I mean, they covered an awful lot of territory. This was a sprawling series. As you said, it took 2 years for Jennifer Dixon to oversee this and write this and research this. What did they get right? Are you willing to concede they got something right here?
Boy, the conclusions were wrong. They missed facts. They missed they omitted things that they had and we'd actually discussed in great detail. So I'm not sure, Mark. We have the privilege of working with media all over the state and to work with Jennifer Dixon, the Free Press, over that 20 months, spent hours. They talked to experts, they talked to schools, we gave them audits and records and made everything public, and some of it they just chose not to look at. I don't know why they came up with the conclusions they did. It doesn't add up.
How common is it that boards are not as transparent as they should be, do you think?
They're all public institutions, and there's a lot of information there, and it's, again, kind of a frustration, frankly. The conclusions were drawn as they are. There's approximately 1,500 some board members on these 300 public charter schools across the state. These are public officials. They swear an oath of office just like any other public official. I've heard from a lot of them, and they're all pretty insulted by that series, that people think they're not getting information, reviewing it, and holding people accountable.
What do you think, Superintendent? I'm asking you to speculate here, but Superintendent Flanagan holds some cards here. I mean, what do you think? Did the series make an impact on him?
I wouldn't want to speculate what that impact is. I think in some ways he's probably feeling like the rest of us, unfortunate, because he was already engaged in the conversation. He was meeting with authorizers in February regarding these discussions, what's my authority, which had come about because of ongoing discussions with the department from a year ago. Charter schools are becoming a bigger and more important part of the educational landscape, and he recognizes that. So he started to do what a good superintendent would do, which is get input. Before I face this circumstance, I want to know, how would I go about this? Because he'll take his responsibilities seriously. So I think in some ways it's a limelight that doesn't help a practical conversation.
The management companies that oversee a lot of the charter schools, though, they have this kind of neither fish nor fowl kinds of they're privately held companies. They're for-profit companies. Is there a challenge in getting those for-profit companies to be as transparent as they should be, or would you assert that they're being as transparent already as they need to be?
There's a public regulation that describes what should be made public, and yes, those companies are monitoring that. A good part of the discussion on Wednesday was exactly how do you go about that. What's apparent when you're digging into the details is, well, that report is available, but it's over here on this website, and people are looking over there on another website, or it's provided to the board, but maybe not to the department in the same way. So looking at consistency and making sure it's accessible. And yeah, these are public-private partnership issues. Anybody that provides private entity that provides a public service. How is that information made public and how easily accessible is it? And I think another important question mark is, what does it have to do with academic outcomes? We have to recognize there are adults in these discussions who have an agenda, and it may not be about student outcomes.
Part of your response to this chapter has been to assert that traditional public schools really ought to be held to many of the same standards, perhaps, that Michigan charter schools. You launched a website, I Support the Pledge. That's really what that was all about. Where does your effort, this online effort with I Support the Pledge, where does that stand?
Well, we'll continue to promote those ideas. We do need how do you evaluate a charter school authorizer? Academic outcomes would be one. We've got a really confusing system in Michigan about doing that for any of our public schools. We need a clearly, easily understandable A through F letter grading system. We grade our kids, we should grade our schools, not just charter schools, but all schools. And then let's focus on literacy. And then below that, yeah, absolutely. Are the dollars being spent? Is there enough information available that people can make good decisions about whether the business practices are being well done and that it's actually driving student outcomes? Should be held accountable to everybody.
I've got to ask you to gaze in your crystal ball. What lay ahead in your view? Where is the public discussion regarding charter schools in Michigan? Where is that going, do you think? What do you expect to see happen?
Charter schools will continue to be an important part of the public education landscape. 9% of the kids are in charter public schools in Michigan. And you'll continue to see authorizers doing their jobs, closing schools, because we see that regularly, or intervening and making sure they're really excelling. You'll see the department continue to monitor and oversee their efforts. You'll see new and exciting kinds of public and private partnerships that charter schools are able to do. And then, yeah, there needs to be a discussion about all public education. It's important to focus on what we're doing, but let's talk about the other 90% of the schools in the state and how those dollars are being spent.
Dan Quisenberry heads the Michigan Association of Public School Academies. Thank you very much, Dan. We'll have you back.
Thank you, Mark. And all again, right. Thanks for the music.
Okay. Heartland Klezmerim on Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. David Klein on trumpet, Drew Howard on banjo and mandolin, Chris Hamilton on bass, and Ben Gadosian on drums. We'll be chatting with Heartland Klezmerim a little bit later on this hour. They'll be performing at the Great Lakes Folk Festival as well next weekend in East Lansing. MERS News reports today Michigan civil rights attorney Godfrey Dillard will announce today that he will seek the Democratic nomination for Secretary of State. That means the end of his bid for Attorney General, which he had announced a couple of months ago. And MERS says his decision to seek the Secretary of State's Post addresses two issues the Michigan Democratic Party was working to resolve before its convention the 23rd of this month, the lack of a candidate for Secretary of State and a potentially nasty fight in the AG nomination. That from MERS News. Its current state, few sites on the American landscape are as iconic as an old-fashioned farm windmill. From the era of the Civil War through today, they harnessed the wind to pump water and run machinery. Today, farmers have other means of generating power. Four farms in Michigan have just been selected by Consumers Energy to produce electricity using anaerobic digesters. The closest one in mid-Michigan is in Elsie in Clinton County, and current state's Kevin Lavery is about to tell us more. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. Elsie is your neck of the woods, I believe.
That's right.
You grew up in Ovid,
indeed,
right next door.
Indeed.
So, and that's dairy country. It's well known that cow manure contains methane gas, which makes an excellent fuel to run electric generators. In the industry, this is affectionately known as poop to power. Green Meadow Farms is one of the largest dairy operations in the region, and back in 2007, they used a grant from Michigan State University to install an anaerobic digester on the farm. Now think about your own body for a minute. Your stomach metabolizes that donut that you promised yourself you would not eat this morning and converts the sugars and other stuff, mainly sugars, into energy. Well, Green Meadow Farms has three stomachs, quote-unquote. Each of them holds 1 million gallons of something that's not quite as tasty as that donut.
You notice as you're standing here by the digesters, there's not a manure smell as you would have if you were standing by untreated manure. That's one of the advantages that the farm does pick up with the digesters online.
That's a very big benefit. It really helps with your neighbor relations.
That's Chad Antle, the owner of Swedish Biogas in Flint, and Darcy Green, co-owner of Green Meadow Farms. We're standing beside those three enormous million-gallon tanks that make up the heart of the digester. To say there's no smell isn't exactly true. To the layman, that would be me, the odor is undeniable. But my two hosts barely notice. A Texas oil man might say it smells like money. Just inside a large pole barn, a network of pumps sends the product to a boiler and a heat exchanger. It's vital to heat the manure to a certain temperature in order to get the optimal release of methane. The waste from 3,200 milk cows is substantial. Darcy Green says before they started using the digester, they would simply use the manure for fertilizer. That's still the case, but now it provides an extra value.
This just added one step in the process that we do. You're getting pretty much everything out that you're putting in. So it's just one more step to be more energy efficient, environmentally friendly.
The digester uses a vacuum system to extract the methane from the manure, and then it's fed into an engine. Chad Antle says from there, the process works the same way as with other fuels like natural gas.
The methane provides the horsepower, the BTUs, the thermal energy to allow those pistons to drive up and down.
Green Meadow Farms is not hooked up to the electric grid just yet. But when it is, the farm could produce as much as 800 kilowatts for Consumers Energy. It's part of the utility's strategy to diversify its arsenal of renewable energy assets, which include wind, solar, biomass, and hydroelectric dams. This farm and three others in West Michigan will eventually become mini substations strong enough to power 2,800 homes. David Ronk is director of transactions and wholesale settlements with Consumers Energy. He says the digester program gives farmers a revenue stream to handle their waste disposal needs. And Ronk says it helps Consumers Energy reduce the risks associated with any one particular energy technology.
With this particular program, we've tried to encourage the various agricultural interests to figure out ways of being more cost-effective so that the price can get to a point where it's competitive with some of the other renewables like wind power generation.
And that's the tough part. Even with financial help, turning a farm into a competitor in the energy market is a costly proposition. The Michigan Farm Bureau supports incentives that help farmers become energy independent. But the Bureau's Laura Campbell believes farm-based energy programs have not progressed as quickly as they should, in part because of the rate of return they get from the power companies.
If you're going to put in a digester, which is no small expense, I mean, you're talking millions of dollars by the time you're done, you've got to be able to recoup your investment. You know, if you're making 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt hour off of the power that you're generating there, it's going to take you a long time to recoup that investment.
Consumers Energy is offering Green Meadow Farms a fixed-price contract for the wattage they'll provide. But Darcy Green can't say when she'll break even.
That's a very, very tricky question. Methane digesters are a very pricey project. Consumers Energy is giving us an opportunity to recoup some of those costs, but it'll be many, many years before we get enough money out of just the electricity prices to pay for something like this, if ever.
In the meantime, do you get a subsidy from them to operate this every day?
No.
So it's out of your own pocket to run it then?
Yes.
In time, Green Meadow Farms could grow beyond its manure to methane experiments. Chad Antle, the biogas expert, says this project doesn't push the digester to its full capacity. In many states, anaerobic digesters process food waste that would otherwise end up in landfills. Antle says in terms of volume, food waste produces more biogas energy than manure. And he says that's where public thinking is headed anyway.
Just as we've seen with recycling of plastics, metals, glasses, things like that, with generations from the 80s to now, you'll see that next generation start looking at recycling food waste and organics much more so and trying to divert those from the landfill.
For now, though, Darcy Green feels satisfied with her role as an environmental steward. Still, she likes the idea that her dairy farm might one day power her neighbor's lights and appliances.
Hopefully. I mean, it's kind of nice to know that when you go to bed at night, you're being environmentally conscious and you are doing the best job that you can, not only for this generation, but the future generations, and just taking care of the land and whatnot.
But let's not forget to give the credit to our friend the cow. We humans have her to thank for the milk we drink at breakfast, and maybe soon for the electricity that runs the fridge that keeps the milk jug cold. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious, the sounds of Heartland Klezmorim, who will be performing at the Great Lakes Folk Festival next weekend. We'll meet the members of the band coming up in just a little bit. Next time you're listening online, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/currentstate. Follow us on Twitter at @KARCurrentState. Lansing-born Arsinoe Selden may not be a household name today, but for several decades in the early 20th century, the death-defying aerialist thrilled thousands at state fairs and traveling circuses. A profile of Selden's life and times was recently featured in Michigan History Magazine in an article from MSU grad Jake Makowski. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Makowski by phone yesterday. Jake said that the barrel-chested Arsinoe Selden began his performing career as a trapeze artist. Selden then created his renowned act, which included flying over the heads of amazed onlookers atop a 100-foot sway pole and completing his performance with the slide for life.
The sway pole is kind of what you think is a very tall pole, usually over 100 feet in length, and it's either dug right into the ground or attached to various rigging that even puts you higher in the air. And what the performer does is they climb up that pole completely unsupported. The performer without a net to the very top, and at the top there was a little platform about the size of your car steering wheel, and he would go on there and do handstands and things all the while swaying back and forth. His record was actually 160 feet in the air, and he swayed to about an angle of 60 degrees, which was absolutely mind-blowing.
When I read that in your article, I actually became physically uncomfortable in my stomach.
I get a little woozy when I get up on the ladder a couple feet, and I don't even know how he could possibly do that.
So he would sway back and forth up to 60 feet at a height of 160 feet, and then he would complete the act with what was called the slide for life. Describe that.
Yep, and it's exactly what it sounds like. There would be a wire and a little like pulley apparatus attached to the top of the rigging and extending downward to the ground, and he would attach himself usually kind of through a little loop around his head and then slide down the wire completely unsupported. If I guess maybe a strong gust of wind happened, he could potentially fall out and literally put his life on the line there.
That's incredible. So actually, it sounds like kind of a zip line, but instead of a harness and a belt and a big carabiner or whatever, it was attached to his head.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of a zip line for the very brave and bold, and I think that was kind of the allure of it. And he would slide, and in the article there's a great picture of him just resting back with his arms out, just kind of gliding right on down to the ground, and it's pretty incredible.
This is Peter Worf for Current State. I'm speaking with Jake Makowski of the Detroit Institute of Arts, and he wrote a recent article for Michigan History Magazine entitled Stratosphere Man. We're talking about the performer Arzeno Seldon. I guess he ziplined or slid for life about 500 feet was his maximum. That is amazing.
Yeah, and he was risky, and he actually had a couple of a close call there, but he ended up doing it all over the country, and he performed again and again at different state fair events and things like that. And everybody called him a trooper, and even if he was feeling well, or he was a consummate professional and always gave it his best and performed fantastic.
You wrote in the article that Seldon had a major crash. You'd imagine he had accidents from time to time, but a major accident in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1944. Can you describe that?
It was during one of his performances, and he was sliding down, and he built up a little too much speed and actually crashed into the anchor that was holding the line to the ground, and he actually broke his neck, a part of his neck and collarbone and several ribs. During the thing, but miraculously, I think doctors still don't know how it happened. He was back performing in just a matter of weeks, doing the same performances over and over again. So it was incredible.
He sounds like, and in the photos that you included, he of course looks like a tough character. I mean, you know, barrel chested and just what you would imagine an aerialist to look like.
I think so. Well, you have to have all that upper body strength to support yourself. And previously, into the kind of his before his fame as the Stratosphere Man, he worked for a long time as a trapeze artist, and naturally holding yourself up and swinging around and tossing different partners back and forth, that has to build up a lot of strength. But he was a very a fit man, and he looked the part.
You describe how Seldon's wife died in a tragic accident.
Yes, that was quite bad. You can tell that he was kind of bent up. His wife, Inez, died in a performance in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It was a 35-foot fall from a trapeze, and she was holding onto the trapeze, biting onto the bar with her mouth, and she suffered kind of a jaw paralysis that locked her into place, and she wasn't able to let go naturally. Swaying too far and then eventually releasing at the wrong time, and she sadly plummeted to her death.
Well, I just wanted to ask you sort of your own personal impressions about this guy.
He was a very smart man. He helped build his own equipment, and because of the make it all kind of custom using his own kind of special metal alloy. And it took his five guys to erect this whole rigging in 15 hours. So it was very industrious, and he dedicated himself to his craft, and he was a real go-getter.
Yeah, it was really involved. I mean, it's much more complicated than just climbing on top of a pole. He designed his equipment, as you indicated in the article too, using special materials that had unique properties and strengths.
Yes, and we sadly, I was actually unable to uncover what it was. It was at his for his request upon his death for all his stuff to be destroyed. That way to kind of like the magician to kind of keep everybody guessing on what he did. So yeah, it was kind of, it was very much performance based, and some of the stuff was kind of magic. In fact, he pioneered the technology of the breakaway sway pole. The sway pole attached to rigging, and he would go up top, perform his swaying acrobatics, and then at a certain point he would hit a release, and the pole would look like it break and swing down, kind of leaving the audience to gasp and in horror that he thought, oh my God, what just happened? The pole broke. Unbeknownst to that, he was perfectly fine and emerged unscathed.
He actually tricked people into thinking, oh my God, something broke, or like the pole snapped and he's going to die, right?
Yeah, I can't believe, I know personally, if I were not expecting it, I would be utterly shocked. And that's the one thing you look for when you hear the stories of the man who crosses the Grand Canyon on the tightrope, or these things like that. They look like they're going to fall. I let them, unbeknownst to us, it's all part of the plan, and we're just going to play it up to the crowd. And you seem to be quite the performer.
I love that. I think that was my favorite part of your article, was where you talked about the breakaway pole.
Yeah, definitely.
Jake Makowski recently wrote the article Stratosphere Man, the story of Lansing-born aerialist Arzeno Selden, for Michigan History Magazine. Jake, thanks so much for telling this unusual and interesting story.
Oh, no problem at all. It's been 6 p.m.
For Current State, this is Peter Warp.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. A once vibrant green space in Lansing, shuttered nearly three decades ago, has come back to life. Yesterday, Mayor Virge Bernero and others stood on a new boat dock on a 15-acre lake to cut the ribbon reopening of Ralph W. Krego Park. The city's largest public park was closed in 1986 when toxic chemicals were found on the site. Now, after a state and city-funded environmental cleanup, the park named for Lansing's longest-serving mayor is open for business. Current State's Kevin Lavery was there to see the rebirth of this hidden gem, and he filed this audio postcard.
Welcome to the re-established, refurbished, all-new and improved Krego Park.
Go ahead and start pushing in here a little bit. I'll hold you.
Yep. All right, ready for this?
My name's Paul Brogan.
And you're with Rivertown Adventures?
Rivertown Adventures, yep. Pretty much anyone we talk to has no idea that there's this beautiful 15-acre lake right here in Lansing, and so close to the River Trail and the Red Cedar River. So it's great that they're getting the exposure out here today and getting these kids out kayaking, learning something new. It's just beautiful. It's a lot of fun.
We have a field trip here today, and we brought a bunch of balls and a frisbee and we're playing kids versus counselors keep away right now.
Who's winning so far?
I would have to say I think the counselors, actually.
But there's still time for you guys to score a victory, I'm sure.
Yes.
Okay, let's take our bait off, and then we're going to walk our fishing rods right up to the picnic table, okay?
You didn't get a fish?
Uh-uh.
Did you try?
Yes.
Maybe you'll try again later, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody is flying a small white drone over Fidelity Lake. I have found our drone pilot. What's your name?
I'm Austin Howard. This is a helicopter we use to fly GoPro cameras, action cameras, with the City of Lansing. So we use it for some of our TV shows we do for City TV. So just getting some B-roll shots of the ribbon cutting here at Kruger Park today.
And having some fun while you're
yes,
doing it.
Of course, yes.
Beautiful. Brats on a sunny day down by the lake.
My name is Greg Minshall. I am with ENG. We're an engineering firm that was selected by the city to do the design of this park.
It's a rebirth.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's a reuse of property that was formerly contaminated. That all got cleaned up and tested, contamination free. You'll notice the parking lot there is all pervious pavement. So like when the rain hits it, it soaks in instead of running off. And it actually filters before it gets finds its way underground to the lake. So there's some little environmental things that you don't notice here that are really nice.
All right, ready for the count. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Yay!
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Live Music Friday is today. We've been enjoying the sounds of Heartland Klezmorim, a Lansing-based ensemble that will be playing in next weekend's Great Lakes Folk Festival in East Lansing. David Klein, Ben Gadoshian, Chris Hamilton, and Drew Howard are all in the studio today. Let's listen to them perform Ma Yophis, Heartland Klezmorim. Thank you. Heartland Klezmorim on Current State here on WKAR. It's David Klein, Ben Gadoshian, Chris Hamilton, and Drew Howard, who is a previous visitor to Current State and the spokesman for Heartland Klezmorim. Welcome back, Drew.
Good morning, Mark.
With a life of a gigging musician.
Yes, yes. Radio, Orthodox weddings, I tell you, it's the life.
Death metal one day, klezmer the next. You never know what to
do. Well, we got to work where we can work.
Give us a good working definition of klezmer. What constitutes klezmer music?
Well, klezmer music is Eastern European creation, but it's also an American creation given the instruments that we're using. Right, David?
Yeah. That is correct.
David's the trumpet player in the band here. So,
basically, klezmer music is the dance celebration music of the East European Yiddish-speaking Jews. This is the music you would have heard at bar mitzvahs, bat mitzvahs, a chasana, which is, of course, Yiddish for wedding. And so this is what this music is. It's celebration music. And in Yiddish, we have a word called simcha, which means celebration. This is simcha music.
It sounds fun to play as a musician.
It is.
It's got to be. Yeah. And now, does klezmer music, is it klezmer without a horn? I think every klezmer band I've ever seen has a... Often it's a clarinet. You play a trumpet, David. Is it klezmer music without a horn? That's my question.
Well, klezmer music is the music, and it's never so much the instrumentation.
Okay. And what makes it fun to play?
The events that we play, we're the band. When you go to a bar mitzvah or a wedding and they put somebody in a chair and hold the chair up and dance around, that's what we do.
Okay.
That is the behavior that we hopefully incite with our infectious dance music.
You're inciting all kinds of behavior.
I hope so. I hope to incite Joe later on.
How long have you guys performed as a band, David?
We've been together since August of 2006.
Okay. And you have an opportunity to stay pretty busy as a klezmer band.
More, I mean,
you
have time.
It locked. You pretty much got the klezmer locked down in this area.
We kind of do. David's a real pioneer in getting us into folk festivals that have never had this kind of music before. Dance festivals and Great Lakes Folk Festivals had klezmer groups before, but Wheatland Dance Camp, for one, I don't think has ever had a klezmer group. So David's really been pioneering getting us into these new venues, as well as the traditional events we play, Orthodox weddings, bar mitzvahs, and things like that.
You're listening to Drew Howard and David Klein talking about their band, Heartland Klezmorim, I beg your pardon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Accent on the right syllable there. They'll be performing at the Great Lakes Folk Festival next weekend. David, tell us about your new CD, I Love You Much Too Much.
Well, this was a CD we recorded last fall, and a lot of it is music that we've been playing for quite some time. It is music that is both traditional and also from the Yiddish theater, and a lot of the music from the Yiddish theater was actually very influenced, at least the Yiddish theater here in America began to get influenced by jazz. And so we began to really put a lot of that into our repertoire, and it is absolutely wonderful to play all of it in combinations, sometimes doing different takes on the traditional tunes, of course, really jazzing up the old Yiddish theater tunes, and that's a lot of fun.
Now, do you have klezmer? There's got to be klezmer music enthusiasts, I take it.
I think there are, yes. It's still kind of an obscure music form, to be sure, and so it's new to a lot of people's ears.
Yeah.
What is this that I'm hearing? I mean, some of the music, some of what klezmer uses are modes, musical modes that are not Western in sound at all. And so that gives it a new sound to people as well. So, but we've been playing right along here at the East Lansing Art Festival for years and stuff. So we're slowly converting people, or if not converting, making new friends.
There are only friends you haven't met yet, right?
Exactly.
Is that it? What's your performance schedule like next weekend?
Well, David, we're going to be at the Great Lakes Folk Festival, and there's a wonderful group of people we've been working with over there. We thank them. And, of course, the MSU Museum. So we've been working with them, and we're going to have a schedule Friday night at 6:30. We're going to be in the dance tent. Saturday at 2 o'clock, we'll be in the dance tent. At 8 o'clock Saturday evening, we'll be playing a concert on the City Hall stage. And Sunday, we'll be back on the dance tent starting at 12:30.
Heartland Klezmorim of Lansing, klezmer music next weekend at the Great Lakes Folk Festival. We'll let you guys retake your seats here because we're going to let these guys play us out. Next week on Current State, we have guests from the Lansing School District. Peter Spadafore and Yvonne Kamal Kanul discuss strategic plans. We'll also stay up to date with the upcoming primary elections, and we'll be coming to you live Friday evening from the Great Lakes Folk Festival in East Lansing. That and more next week on Current State. It's Heartland Klezmorim. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us here on Current State on WKAR.